This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Tattoos date back more than 5,000 years. Working-class Europeans had them, but so did the very rich and powerful.
So you have men and women in the upper class getting tattoos as a sign of status.
Alexis Wohlstein with ISU's Milner Library and Laura Kennedy tour the library's tattoo exhibit, Your Body, Your Canvas. You'll hear another in our series of Normal 150 interviews observing the town's sesquicentennial, this time on a topic not to be celebrated, racial segregation. And John Norton is back haunting an area record store for another edition of What's on Your Turntable. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's September 24th, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For some, the body is a temple. For others, the temple is more ornate, expressing a unique point of view. A new exhibit at Illinois State University's Milner Library explores the various ways people can express themselves and how body art has evolved over the years. Laura Kennedy has more.
Tattoos, piercing, scarification, and more help individuals be, well, individual and create a personal narrative through art-adorned bodies. The exhibit, Your Body, Your Canvas, highlights what was once hidden or taboo and explores how body art evolved to become mainstream. Alexis Spall Wohlstein is an instruction librarian at Milner Library and curator of Your Body, Your Canvas. She says there was plenty of material within the various collections at Milner Library to build this exhibit. And they also borrowed materials from Chicago's Leather Archives and Museum. Wohlstein says so many students have embraced body art through tattoos, piercing, and more that the time just seemed right for a closer look.
We really wanted to look at body modification as a whole and using your body as a medium for your expression. So we've covered dance, hair styles, fancy nails, anything that students do to kind of use their body as a way to express themselves.
What sort of reasons are there for people to do body art?
Well, there's a long history going back to tribal ceremonies. Some of the largest pieces we have on display are posters from our circus collection.
From Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey.
Right, Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. This one looks at a tribe of genuine Ubangi savages, which is a terribly offensive way to refer to them now. So we have, in the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey poster, examples of disc lips, a little difficult to say that one, where you would see the lip extended with an actual wooden disc in there until it was a permanent kind of look, as well as scarification. And then in what is one of my favorites is our Hagenbach and Wallace Circus poster looking at the giraffe neck women of Burma.
They have the rings around their necks to lengthen it.
Right, which would extend their necks by a great deal. These women, along with being in the circus, were toured all over Europe and England during that same period, again, as exotic examples of different lifestyles. Unfortunately, at that point, they were more or less treated as objects, but I really wanted to include these in there to show that there's a long history of it and that we can give some humanity back to them.
What about tattoos? How far back do tattoos go?
Well, the earliest tattoos that we know of around now have been carbon dated to be about 5,200 years old. They recently found another frozen body along the Italian-Austrian border with tattoos along the fingertips and along the arms. All of these would have been symbolic of some kind of coming of age or rite of passage. And the carbon dating has dated them back over 5,000 years. And we wanted to demonstrate not just that tattoos are going to be the type of body art that you think of, although it is the one that our students automatically go to. But again, henna and mendi, which we still see as a very popular thing, head flattening, the flattening of breasts and genital mutilation, which, you know, at this point, luckily, most of these tribes have moved away from, but also very specific shaving of the hair, scarification, other piercings. All of these had very symbolic meanings within this tribal culture. One of the things that surprised me most as I was going through was that it also was very prominent later on amongst royalty, because the kings would have tattoos from the distant lands that they had visited to mark battles and other types of travels that they had done. One of my favorite stories from that was a kind of conspiracy theory that towards the end of the reign of the Romanovs, Alexei, who would have been the czar if the family hadn't met its end during the Russian Revolution, he was a hemophiliac. And so they made very certain that he wasn't going to get these tattoos that his father would have already had, that would already have marked some of the rites of passage he had gone through. Whereas Rasputin, our fantastical Russian magician, had gone through and encouraged that instead they should tattoo his body with magical emblems that would save him from the hemophilia. And of course, the conspiracy theory behind that was that Rasputin was well aware of the hemophilia and wanted to use poison ink and use it to kill Alexei in the process, something that I had never heard before. So it goes back not just to the tribal and exotic kind of locales that we think of, but to European royalty. And then in the Victorian age, the people who we would have thought of as the 1% and now in today's terms, they were very into getting tattoos as well, because they didn't have to worry about any societal discrimination. So you have men and women in the upper class getting tattoos as a sign of status as well.
Well, when did societal discrimination enter into it? Have tattoos always been acceptable, or other types of body art?
No, very much not so. It's always been present in certain subcultures, and a lot of time it was an identifying factor of the subcultures. In America, one of the first places we saw it becoming acceptable was with men coming back from World War I and World War II in the armed forces, again, marking their travels abroad, connecting them with their fellow soldiers and the like. Piercing took even longer to become more acceptable. Not until probably the early 90s did body piercing, anything beyond a woman piercing her ears, become at all acceptable in a mainstream culture. Prior to that, it was very much involved in the kink and fetish culture, particularly among gay males. In San Francisco in the 1970s, the first exclusively piercing parlor was opened by Jim Ward, who has been known as the grandfather of American piercing. He was dubbed that by MTV about 20 years ago, when piercing was first becoming mainstream as well. But he opened the Gauntlet in 1975, and it was very, like I said, connected to kink and fetish, so we had to be very careful about which materials we displayed from that period. We were lucky enough to be loaned some original pieces from the Gauntlet by Chicago's Leather Archives and Museum. But again, as it was related to fetish culture, the septum piercings and the ear piercings and the other type of body piercings that I see on all of our students walking across campus these days, those were still very culturally unacceptable, not to mention the genital piercings and the other type of kink-related sexual satisfaction piercings that went along with it. I was definitely surprised in my research by just how many piercings one can fit into a penis.
And how many would that be?
I have seen photos of upwards of 30 tattoos in one penis. One that I saw in particular that was very interesting was a woman's vagina that had a piercing that required a lock and key to show that you had to have permission to get in there.
That's quite the chastity belt.
Yeah, to say the least.
Let's take a look at some of the photos you have over here. Some historic photos?
Yes, ma'am.
Are these daguerreotypes?
They're daguerreotypes and cabinet cards. These are from our Circus and Allied Arts collection here at Milner Library Special Collections. There was a period where being a tattooed individual made you a curiosity, and they performed. They actually had more social credibility than some of the other characters you would see in freak shows and sideshows, because they could cover their performance, the art that they wore on their body. But again, many of these people made their living traveling, showing their different tattoos, selling cabinet cards like these as souvenirs.
We have Lady Viola, the tattooed woman. I wonder if she inspired that song, Lydia the Tattooed Lady, you know, that Groucho Marx used to sing.
Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia the Tattooed Lady. She has eyes that folks adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo. Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus too. And proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia.
Now we're moving along in the exhibit to some more modern photographs. How have tattoos changed over the years regarding the subject matter?
Well, the subject matter with your military or armed forces gentlemen were very typically representations of what part of the armed forces they were part of. One of the classic tattoos that most people think of when they think of that is the swallow flying over open seas. And Navy men would wear that tattoo to show that they would be able to get home at the end. I was really excited to see that one of our veteran students actually had that exact tattoo and knew the meaning, and that still lives on. Over the years, particularly after post-World War II, and you saw more of these men heavily tattooed coming home, tattooing became to spread to people who just weren't just in the armed forces. One of my favorite things we have in the service collection is a self-published autobiography by Miss Cindy Ray of Australia, who was one of the first distinctive female tattoo artists, and I wish that some publisher would pick up that book and share it with the world, because her voice is absolutely charming. One of the first major figures in American tattooing was a fellow named Sailor Jerry, who most people will probably recognize as being a brand of rum at this point. But he was the father of Americana-style tattooing. So that's the heavy lines, bright colors, things like, you know, pinups and anchors and the like that we kind of think of when we think of 1950s, 1960s tattooing. And we're very lucky to have some original Sailor Jerry acetates and sketches on display here in the exhibit.
Well, in this next cabinet, we seem to be in modern day with regards to the tattoos. And these were done by local tattoo artists?
Yeah, so we've been very lucky to work with two Central Illinois tattoo shops, one Vintage Karma in Tuscola, Illinois, with Ainsley Heinlich and Brian Lynch, both very talented. Most of the photos you see here are from a pair of artists at North Street Tattoo, which is just in Uptown. Steve McClintock, who is a specialist in the Japanese style. We have Salah of his work on display.
That dragon is jaw-dropping. It takes up most of that man's torso.
Yes, Steve specializes in the Japanese style, which would be associated primarily in Japan with the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia, and for that reason, it's still very not normal for a Japanese individual to have a tattoo, because it's still so strongly associated with the Yakuza. In one of the other display cases, we have what appears to be like a cutout of a tattoo scene. Well, it's actually a preserved human skin. There is a Japanese academic who has collected many of the skins of these Yakuza individuals, and they're literally tattooed from chin to ankle to wrist, and has preserved over 150 of them.
There's so many reasons over the centuries why people get tattoos, mm-hmm. whether it's a sign of a rite of passage or to indicate your travels or what have you. Why do people get tattoos and other body art today?
Well, I think that's one of the myths that we've been trying to bust, is that there's not necessarily a meaning behind every tattoo. They're just frankly beautiful and can become a way to take control of your body, make it your canvas, and use it as a way to express yourself that is strictly yours. Nobody else can use your body as their canvas. And the styles have changed over the years hugely. We have Americana styles, like I mentioned, with Sailor Jerry on display here by Alex Godere, another one of the tattoo artists from North Street. It's very impressive. I get blown away on a regular basis by just how talented these artists are. And they're working on a terribly difficult medium. You know, the human skin is not like having a strict canvas that you can paint on, correct a mistake, throw it out if you didn't like what happened. This is somebody's skin that's going to be there permanently.
Well, speaking of a canvas, you are expanding beyond the canvas of this exhibition with Your Body, Your Canvas. You're involving social media. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, actually, that's been one of my most satisfying aspects of this exhibit. We really wanted to touch not just ISU and the collection that we have here at Milner, but also reach out to the student body, reach out to the Central Illinois community, and beyond that, with our connections to the museum in Chicago. One of the ways that we've done that is we've had students submit their own body art, and we have a digital slideshow going that will be updated over the 2 months that the exhibit is running. We've been having students use the hashtag Your Body, Your Canvas, ISU on any social media platform that supports hashtags. We've been collecting those, and I have pretty much been going out and also asking any student that I see with a tattoo, may I take a picture? And it's kind of amazing just how excited everyone is to show their tattoo.
Is that what's right behind us
Yes.
on this computer screen?
Exactly. And students have just been tickled to come and see their work on a screen in the library as part of an exhibit. And it's been really satisfying to give them the opportunity and to show the extreme variety of tattoos and body arts that our student wears and the emotional connection they have to them. Some students who have shared it on social media have told us the story behind the tattoo, behind the body art, and I have choked up at several of the stories. These are very meaningful things for people. They're not just flippantly going into something that's going to be on their body for life.
You have several tattoos. Which one's your favorite?
Oh, that's a very hard question. All of my tattoos have a meaning to me, even if they're just beautiful and something that, you know, makes me happy. I have a memorial tattoo for my mother, so that is very significant to me. I have a tattoo that I got with several girlfriends where we all got variations on the same thing. I have a tattoo that is a Hamsa that guards against the evil eye, which is something that my grandmother, my little Russian gypsy grandmother always did. So again, they all have a lot of meaning, but tattoos don't have to mean anything. They can just be something that you find beautiful, something that you want to place on your body. And of course, there are also other meanings to tattoos that aren't quite as heartwarming.
Like gang members.
Right, exactly. One of the things that we have on display is actually a tattoo kit that was confiscated from a prisoner at the Ohio State Penitentiary. It's entirely functional. You can see that it's made of two cardboard tubes that are full of AA batteries. Other pieces that are very recognizable is the head of a ballpoint pen, half of a pair of tweezers, the cord from a pair of earbuds. All of these kind of come together to make a tattoo gun, because in prison, a lot of time, who you are tattooed and associated with is what gets you through the unfortunate experience of being in prison. Of course, they're not safe. They're very often not sanitary. The pain and the infection that must go along with bad home tattooing, prison tattooing, or stick and poke tattooing, all of these kind of things that kids are like, oh yeah, I'm just going to go to a guy's backyard, a guy's garage and get a tattoo there. We're trying to show what a bad idea that is as well.
Body art and tattoos in particular, very, very popular right now, really gone mainstream. Will it stay mainstream, or do you see that people will essentially look at this as just too ubiquitous and maybe move away from it as a way of making a statement?
I think that's a really good question. The thing that I encourage people who ask me about tattoos and body art is do something that's meaningful for you. There is a lot of what, as a librarian, I would see as plagiarism or intellectual property stealing in the tattoo community. You see it on Pinterest. People take it to a tattoo artist. They make a sketch of it. They put it on your body. And then you have the same tattoo as dozens of other people. I don't see this as a trend that's going to go away. I think that we'll see the type of body art expand and change over the years. When I was a undergrad, belly button rings were very popular. Not so much now. But I never expected to walk across campus and see so many young men and women with septum piercings. It's a very, very popular one right now as well. There are types of body modification that I don't ever see becoming extremely popular beyond a very specific community, like, say, scarification or 3D implants or tongue splitting, all of these different types of body modification that people have delved into that personally make me kind of shiver at the thought of it. But for some people, this is the way that they feel that they have made their body theirs.
That's Alexis Schwal-Woldstein from ISU's Milner Library.
Your Body, Your Canvas continues through October 31st. I'm Laura Kennedy.
See photos from the Your Body, Your Canvas exhibit at our website, WGLT.org. On October 13th, Milner Library presents Horimino, a retrospective of Japanese tattoo art from the past to the present, with Steve McClintock of North Street Tattoos. That'll be at 6 p.m. on the library's sixth floor. You're listening to The Tombstones, Jailhouse Tattoo on Sound Ideas.
In a graveyard mine. When I'm 22 and I don't mind dying, I got a jailhouse, a tattoo. Straight rage, man, love you.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. As the town of Normal observes its sesquicentennial, there are things in its history that should not be celebrated. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with a retired historian about racial segregation in one of our continuing series of interviews observing Normal 150. Mark Wyman says the division of whites and blacks in Normal was similar to other cities in Illinois.
Bloomington and Normal were not unique. Just without working very hard of it, I came up with stuff on Elgin, Rockford, Peoria, Champaign, Urbana, Decatur, Springfield. Bloomington Normal was right in the typical pattern there. Now, what caused it? Well, there's something about national moods, and maybe it was the Birth of a Nation movie in 1915 that played here that somehow encouraged the Klan, and the Klan was big news around here in the 20s before it finally collapsed at the end of the decade. Certainly by the end of the 20s, the segregation pattern was in place. Hotels, restaurants, movie theaters up sitting in the far back rows.
There's an element of denial, even present today, that happened or could happen. I recall covering a panel on segregation at the Museum of History years ago, when a panelist by the name of Reggie Whitaker talked about having to enter State Farm Insurance by a separate entrance. And Ed Russ Jr. later commented to me that he didn't believe that could have happened.
I call it Bloomington Normal's secret. When I got working on this a few years ago, I began asking white people, did we ever have racial segregation here? And nope, too far north. Nope, never heard of that. I gave a rough draft of the talk I was preparing to an African-American couple, and the wife told me it was no secret with us. It was no secret with us. So it's kind of within the black community, but even the elderly blacks, because Willie Tripp, when he was president of the Black History Project at the Historical Society, once said, people don't know how bad it was. Even black kids don't know how bad it was. So I call it our secret.
How pernicious was it in Normal?
Apparently not in the schools. The interviews that Professor Mildred Pratt did, several people who were from Normal, blacks, commented they just knew no treatment other than what whites got in the school system up through high schools. Then at Illinois State Normal University, they began having separate dances, at least in the 20s. There weren't many black students then. And that continued, well, up through, I think, World War II, or the beginning of World War II, perhaps it ended. So it in college, apparently, it was a little different as on the social scene. But cafes, barbershops, the Normal Theater when it began in 37, blacks had to sit way at the back there.
How did the way people congregate in public shift as well?
Normal only had Fell Park until very late in the period we're talking about. But at Miller Park, there would be quite clear lines between where blacks and whites were. And then in 1908, when the park board said there will be segregation in the swimming area with a separate changing house for blacks and a separate swimming area for blacks in the east end, that meant large protests, and then the Springfield race riot right after that in 1908 just squelched the discussion here, the debate here. And then they tried to get it going again after World War I and 1919. And then the Chicago race riot happened, really bloody. And that again squelched the debate here.
So there was cultural suppression from these outbreaks of violence.
Certainly.
As they were designed to do.
Yeah. And after 1908, black churches had been getting active in protesting. And then after the Springfield riot, one of the African-American ministers wrote a letter to the Pantograph, and he basically said, don't stand around on street corners. Don't say you want to get even. All that has to be ended. Undoubtedly, there was material like that that was not written in the newspaper because the Pantograph kept talking about all the rumors. So that helped put it in place by the 20s.
And how did it ease then? And how late did it ease?
In Normal, there are reports that during World War II, the theater seating began to ease. Black kids would, once the movie started, they would run around and sit down front. A black veteran, home on leave during the war, refused to move, and they didn't make him move. So by the end of World War II, the theater seating has ended. And then right after the war, 1947, a bunch of black and white veterans attending ISNU started picketing a cafe right by campus that refused to serve blacks. And they won. They won. The cafe, after a couple months, just gave in.
So this was ahead of the civil rights movement of the 60s.
And that may be, we need to think a little more about the civil rights movement. So 1947, we have Jackie Robinson playing with the Dodgers and entering Major League. 1948, Harry Truman desegregates the American military. So all these little things are starting to happen, and there are reports from around the country of protests by blacks. And this is before the Supreme Court's ruling in 1954 desegregating schools, and Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks at the end of 1955 on the bus in Montgomery, and then Martin Luther King's rise. So there's this buildup.
Who were the pushers for this change in Normal that allowed it to happen a little ahead of the national mood?
In 1950, there is an organization formed, led by someone at State Farm and then picking up some people from various churches in Bloomington Normal. And they were mainly looking at restaurants, which the segregation there was ending in the 50s. And then 1960, there was a Northern Illinois organization, Freedom of Residence, and the leader came down here and gave a talk, and so that earlier organization kind of melded into Freedom of Residence. And they, in the 60s then, began working on housing. And there were big fights. And you can kind of guess the arguments on should someone who's selling his house have a freedom to sell to whoever he wants to sell to? And so there were big fights and reached the Normal Town Council and the Bloomington Council. And so there were fights in 1967 over how strong an ordinance Normal should have. Bloomington had just passed a very strong ordinance.
Prohibiting housing discrimination.
Prohibiting and just without any exceptions. And Normal was still playing with one that said if the owner occupied it, he could still sell whoever he wanted to sell to.
But so much of this in housing is done not only by a wink and a nod with the realtor and the expectation that certain buyers are going to inquire about certain schools. it is also done by the people that belong to ethnic groups themselves. They Certainly. Tend to segregate themselves because they are familiar with it. And in Illinois Wesleyan University, Professor Narendra Jaggi has done some work about informal redlining that people right. do them to themselves. How do you get that to not happen?
Right, yeah. And that, of course, was a question then. I think they were looking at the more obvious ones then. Ralph Smith and his wife, Ralph was on the faculty at Illinois State.
And a founder of WGLT, we should add.
Oh, good. Their system was they would have a black couple respond to an ad of something, maybe an apartment for rent, and be turned down. And then an hour or so after that, Ralph and his wife would go. And they would be accepted. And they would do that over and over. So that system was the one mainly used then. And, of course, there were some real fights on it and fights in the council. Normal took a big advisory vote end of 67 and whether they should stay with the ordinance passed just a few months earlier that gave exceptions for owner-occupied apartments and houses. And almost half of the voters said, yeah, stick with that. Almost half, a little less than half, said we don't need any ordinance. And then a large number said, yes, we need a stronger ordinance. So it was an enormous fight until then in 68. The state of Illinois passed a flat-out ban on any discrimination, and that's what we still have.
How did the churches in Normal contribute to that struggle? Were they as active as churches in the South?
Several of them. Not a large number, but several of the mainline churches. Ralph Smith called it sensitizing the churches. And they began taking little note cards that had things like, I refuse to discriminate on the basis of race and so forth. But some of the evidence was the other way. Reverend Jim Prine at the Campus Religious Center had his students take around Normal to the almost 300 homes that rented at least a room to students, asking if the owner would sign the statement, I will not discriminate on the basis of race, religion, so forth. 295 were taken. Only 5 would sign. Only 5 would sign in Normal. That's quite a comment on how far the mood had gone.
Pendulums swing. Sometimes they swing the other way, despite Martin Luther King's assertion that the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice.
Yes.
Does our culture stand in danger of expanding racial injustice in this time when anti-immigration settlement is rising in our political discourse?
That's always a danger. And when one looks back through history, one can have some fears. So it's a constant fight. And we don't always have a Martin Luther King to make the point. There's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. And people who believe in equal treatment just need to keep fighting in any way they can.
Mark Wyman is one of the speakers for the Normal 150 celebration. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Historian Mark Wyman speaks at Uptown Station Sunday afternoon about racial segregation in Bloomington Normal as part of the Normal 150 observances. Hear about Normal's boom years next Thursday during Sound Ideas as part of our continuing series of interviews. Coming up, it's an edition of What's on Your Turntable. John Norton stops by Waiting Room Records for some music from the band Windhand. That's still to come during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Studies have shown petting a cat or a dog can lower stress and blood pressure. Dealing with the animal's health costs can increase stress, though. During this edition of Sound Money, Jim Brown discovers the initial cost of buying a pet pales in comparison to the costs of keeping the animal healthy.
Feeding your puppy or kitten and providing a loving home, that's just part of the burden, according to a new survey by Country Financial of some 2,000 Americans. Joe Berman is the Director of Financial Security for the Bloomington-based company and says that over the lifetime of a pet, you can anticipate thousands of dollars in animal care.
And like their human owners, sometimes it's easy to forget to budget for all of those little unexpected items. This year, if you can imagine, we are expected to spend over $60 billion. Not me personally. I know sometimes that feels like that. But all of us together, $60 billion, 25% of that figure, so nearly $16 billion spent on veterinary care. So whether you have small animals, large animals, I truly believe the smallest check that you're going to write is the first one, and that's the purchase price. It's all uphill from there.
Are pet owners anticipating those kinds of costs when they pick up a pet, Joe?
43% of Americans said that their dog or cat has cost them more than expected. Nearly a third of them have spent more than $1,000 in the last 12 months. 1 in 10 said they spent more than $2,000. So it's important to kind of plan ahead, budget for all those unexpected items. Because when you don't, you're forced to make some really hard choices there, and whether it affects your pet's health or the owner's wealth, or both.
And it could very well affect family harmony if you don't make the right call. You know, even if a new pet owner believes that they're ready for the costs associated with pet ownership, there are always those unexpected diseases and injuries. How big a dent can something like, a broken leg on a dog wind up costing someone, Joe?
Huge. If we take out the catastrophic item, I mean, you just think about all the routine stuff you need, whether that's checkups, vaccinations, parasite tests, parasite prevention, teeth cleaning. The list goes on and on. If you have something sort of catastrophic, like a cyst or a skin disorder, or heaven forbid, a dog gets hit by a car. I mean, that can rack up into several thousand dollars very, very quickly. And again, we do love our pets. I mean, one of the things we saw in the survey, 8 in 10 see Fido the dog or Stripey the cat as a family member. That's why we see him in the family photos.
Stripey the cat might not cost you as much as Charlie the lizard. Does the kind of pet make a difference in how much an animal can cost? I assume horses would be very expensive. Turtles, perhaps less so. You have some equestrian experience, Joe.
Gosh, yes. You mentioned horses. Full disclosure, my oldest has 2, and believe it or not, I am, as we speak here right now, in the middle of about $2,500 of veterinary expenses, honestly, between the two of them. One had a little bit of an upset tummy. The other one has had sort of some lameness issues we're dealing with. So, yes, type of pet does matter. Fish might set you back maybe a couple $100 a year. A cat, maybe $1,000, a dog, depending on how big. I mean, maybe $1,300 to $1,800. Again, that's sort of just for the routine care and food and things like that. Horses, you do not want to know. With all respect to my daughter and her mounts, it isn't called the sport of kings for nothing.
What about dog breeds? If you're a dog person, different breeds seem to have unique problems. It seems to me some breeds have like a hip problem, some have intestinal problems. What's a good way to deal with that?
This is an example where the owners really, really need to go in with their eyes wide open, before bringing Rover into the home. Do a little bit of research up front. A lot of the pet associations can be really helpful in this area. For example, like the American Kennel Club can actually break down the cost by breed, showing you which breeds are more likely to have more in grooming costs or tend to have sort of more hip or eye or skin or back issues. Some issues can be genetic, so you'll want to make sure you're purchasing from a reputable breeder, and you want to know how mom and dad's health history have been before you fall in love with the puppy.
It almost sounds like you're courting a future spouse instead of picking up a pet.
It very well could be. And I talk to people all the time about needing to spend more time planning for retirement than they do, planning for a Disney vacation. I wonder if we do more research on cars and Carfax, you're checking out the mileage, the repair history and all that, than we do on that cute little puppy that we just have to have. So again, look at that full cost of ownership and make sure it's right for your family and your finances.
Now, even the most well-prepared pet owner is going to run into unanticipated costs. Is there pet insurance?
There actually is pet insurance. You know, in our survey, we saw that 1 in 4 went and turned down those health expenses if they couldn't afford it. 1 in 3 dipped into their savings. 1 in 3 cut back on daily expenses. 1 in 3 would finance it with a credit card. 1 in 4 go and put off a major purchase. But as you indicated, yes, indeed, there is health insurance that you can purchase for a pet if you so desired.
What are we going to be talking about next time, Joe?
Well, we're going to be a little nostalgic next time. We're going to be taking a look at sort of some historical comparisons and get a read on some trends that we're seeing with Americans' attitudes regarding their finances. So we're going to kind of look back over the years.
Joe Berman, Director of Financial Security for Bloomington-based Country Financial, on a survey of some 2,000 Americans concerning the lifetime costs of owning a pet. I'm Jim Brown.
Country Financial's Joe Berman talking with GLT's Jim Brown. Country Financial's been conducting polls of Americans for over a decade to find out how the country feels about issues like caring for pets, planning for retirement, and other milestones and goals. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from State Farm Bank, proud to support financial literacy as a sponsor of Sound Money. More information at statefarm.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. Occasionally, we send John Norton out to local record stores to hear what customers are hearing as they browse the bins. Norton's trip to Uptown Normal this week pumped some new heavy metal in his ears.
We're listening to the new album by Windhand here at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. It's called Grief's Infernal Flower. And Trevor from Waiting Room Records is spinning another turntable right now. You look a pretty happy guy right now, Trevor.
I'm sorry. I can't hear you. My ears are just being destroyed by this amazing record right now.
This is like Black Sabbath, man.
Yeah, there's definitely some Sabbath tones in there, man. You can definitely figure that out.
Was a couple of years ago when I was down here and Jared and I were talking, and he goes, let me play you something, because you know we were going through different sounds and stuff.
Yeah.
And he put the Soma album on. I'm like, normally I don't like this kind of, but I really dig what that band is doing.
Oh yeah, it was great. Yeah, that was the first album that I had actually heard from them when that came out, and I just fell in love.
Well, give us a little bit of background about Windhand.
Windhand is a band out of Richmond, Virginia. This would be their third full-length album. Soma was preceded by just a self-titled LP and a demo before that. But this is actually their first, major label release. They're on Relapse this time, so, you know, guys like High on Fire are on there. I guess what I would call a folk doom metal band.
Folk doom. It almost seems kind of contradictory.
It does, doesn't it? That's how they describe themselves, and I think it's pretty accurate. I mean, because not only are they this crushing, obviously, doom metal band, but they have these acoustic interludes and other pieces in their songs that kind of have this very folky singer-songwriter type of feel to them, and it just kind of blends into this new kind of metal that you've heard. It all seems kind of familiar, but it all seems also very distinct and different at the same time.
Okay, so we're calling it folk doom, but on the last album that Jared played for me a couple of years ago, there actually was kind of a folky song on there.
Yeah, exactly, and they do that on this album as well, too.
They do, okay. Mm-hmm. What you want? Let's go to that track right now.
Yeah, there's actually two different ones. There is Sparrows, which is track 5 on side B of the record. It's just a solo acoustic vocal piece by the lead singer, Dorothea Cottrell.
And I love it, man, whose love is
it feels more like someone like laying on a grave of a loved one and like lamenting over them. It's very dark and like sort of melancholy and somber, but it still rocks like really hard. It could be turned up to 11 if you wanted it to, but they turn it down and it still sounds just as awesome.
Flowers to blossom in the
it's really interesting to hear these different sounds on the same album from this band.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's very great. It's great. This album, front to back, I love every single track.
Well, take us through another track or two or three here.
Yeah, well, I'll take you with probably my favorite song on the album. It's the track two off of side A. It's called Forest Clouds. And this track was actually previously released on a limited edition 10-inch on Easy Rider Records with another band called Salem's Pot. It was a super limited release, and I heard a stream of it on the internet when it first came out, and I just loved it. It drew me in, and the headline, I think, of the article I read was that the Wind Hand sells their soul to the devil for the riff in this song, and I totally agree. It is a crushing, crushing riff, and it is amazing. They do a new version of it on this album, a new cut under the new producer, Jack Endino, who also did Nirvana's Bleach and Soundgarden's Screaming Life, High on Fire.
It's the new Wind Hand album. We're listening at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. It's spinning on the turntable right now. And Trevor Basham is taking us through this great new release. And it's called Grief's Infernal Flower.
That's right.
You want to take us to another track now?
Absolutely. Go to the next track right after that, track three. It's called Crypt Key. This is their first single, actually, off the album. This has an acoustic intro into it. It's just kind of like strumming like 4-4 sort of, rhythm, very simple. Then it just drops like a hammer into this hypersonic distortion. With these amazing like syncopated guitars and vocals. It's like this entrancing head-banging rhythm that you just cannot stop banging your head to. It is a great track. Solos. They're just the two guitarists are just battling back and forth with these sonic, like hyper distorted guitar solos that are just shredding and battling and going back and forth with each other. It's like a lightning storm inside of a tornado or something, you know? It's just amazing.
We have time for, I think, one more track. Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to. Yeah, this is definitely an album that I love. So far for me, bold statement, I don't care. I'm going to stick with it. It's probably my album of the year right now.
Really?
I love it. I cannot stop listening to it. Every song is fantastic front to back. But yeah, let me take you to side D of the record. This is track A. It's called Kingfisher. This is cool because on the first and second tracks in this track, they have little intros to them. The first track has like kind of like this fire building like slowly in the back. The second song, it's like someone just blew out the fire and now you're just left in the dark. And then with this one, it opens with this like creepy, eerie, like raining, like graveyard feel to it.
Well, let's listen to that for just a second then here, okay?
Okay. Yeah, so it kind of like creates and ends, completes this feeling throughout the whole album. It's kind of like a complete package, like almost like a story. On the track Kingfisher, Dorothea Cottrell's vocals are just so attacking and like conjuring, almost like she's a witch, like trying to cast a spell on you or something. She is just like calling, and it's like the supernatural, aggressive vocals that are just totally different from any other track on the album. And then the guitars are just like this melodic, scraping guitar riffs. To me, like the song feels like someone is trying to bring back a loved one from the dead with like some kind of black magic, Satan worshiping powers, if you will.
Well, his name is Trevor Basham. He works at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. And thank you for taking us through this great new album. Album of the year, according to you?
For me, it definitely is. I hope your ears aren't bleeding too much from...
Well, let's finish with the acoustic track so we can let people kind of just mellow for a little bit.
Absolutely.
All right. Wind Hand is the band, and Grief's Infernal Flower is the name of the album. Thank you, Trevor.
Thanks, John.
Is Wind Hand, their new album, Grief's Infernal Flower. Trevor Basham of Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal shared the music playing on the turntable in the store with GLT's John Norton for another edition of What's on Your Turntable. Let us know what's playing on your turntable or phone or music playing device. Contact us at our website, WGLT.org. That's also where you can send comments about what you hear on Sound Ideas or email us. The address is news@WGLT.org or post at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Find the Sound Ideas podcast produced by Trevor Bauer at our website, including this episode with help from Laura Kennedy, Charlie Schlenker, Jim Brown, John Norton, and Willis Kern. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. This is GLT News and Ideas.